John Grisham has sold more than 60 million books. His back-to-back bestsellers made him the best-selling author of the 1990s. And then there were the movie adaptations. The Firm has grossed more than $270 million worldwide. But before his prodigious career as a writer of popular fiction, John Grisham was a lawyer and a politician, a member of the state legislature in his native Mississippi. His new novel, The Appeal, is set in Mississippi. It's the story of a dirty political campaign for a seat on that state Supreme Court. NPR's Jackie Lydon spoke with him earlier this week.
John Grisham joins me now, and welcome to the program.
My pleasure.
This book is a gripping read. Two trial lawyers have basically leveraged everything to try a case against a big chemical company. Lots of people have been hurt and killed by this company. And they win a local verdict, but then comes the appeal. So what does the big chemical company have to do?
After the big verdict, obviously, there are going to be a lot more lawsuits. And so the chemical company looks around, they survey the political and judicial landscape, and they realize that in Mississippi, like a majority of the states in this country, the appellate court judges on the Supreme Court are elected by the people. So they dive headlong into Mississippi politics with the goal of replacing a judge they consider to be unfriendly with one that they think will be more sympathetic to the chemical company.
So I gather, John Grisham, that you would think that state Supreme Courts in this country are in danger of being bought and sold.
Yes, and it's a terrible problem. It's not unusual in a lot of states for litigants, people with cases on appeal to the state Supreme Court, Ohio, Texas, Alabama, it's all over the place, where the litigants, the big corporations on one side, the big trial lawyers on the other, make huge campaign contributions to the elections of the very judges who are going to be deciding the cases. And oftentimes these judges do not recuse themselves. It is a terrible system.
You know, there was a time when novelists were really known for writing about social issues. I'm thinking of people like Upton Sinclair, who wrote about the meatpacking industry in Chicago, or Lincoln Steffens, Bret Harte, others, who, as the country became more industrialized, wrote about a lot of what happened to workers and what used to be called the common man. Do you see yourself in that tradition?
Occasionally. The last book was The Innocent Man, published a couple of years ago, and it was a story about wrongful convictions and exonerations. And it
a nonfiction book.
Nonfiction book, and there was a lot of anger in that book, because once I researched the story and realized what had happened to these two guys and how it could have easily been prevented, and the way they were abused by the system and also the death penalty system. You know, I think I write two different kinds of books. Some books are just pure entertainment. Others deal with an issue, and I think those are the better books because they make the reader stop and think about something that he or she may not be thinking about.
Let's go back into The Appeal, your novel. You've written a real love letter here to trial lawyers in the book. May I just quote, "Trial lawyers, always a colorful and eclectic bunch. Cowboys, rogues, radicals, long hairs, corporate suits, flamboyant mavericks, bikers, deacons, good old boys, street hustlers, pure ambulance chasers, faces from billboards and yellow pages and early morning television. They were anything but boring."
Listen, that I still love them.
They
are outrageous, and they drive you crazy. I was a member of the trial lawyers for 10 years. I would go to state conventions, and we would almost have fistfights. But it's a group of independent, individualist cowboys, eccentrics, but they love a good fight. They love a good courtroom battle, and they are united in their belief that they are representing little people who have been injured by corporate wrongdoers.
I'm just wondering if there's times when you miss the sort of passion and drama, the crucible that courtrooms can have and wish you were in there, or does writing fiction sate that for you?
I don't think I have ever missed practicing law. I never had any fun in a courtroom. It is very, very stressful work. You know, I'm fortunate enough to be able to sort of do it vicariously through novels. And there are a lot of people who want to write legal thrillers, and I can usually read the first chapter and tell whether or not that person is a lawyer. Because, you know, you have a certain body of knowledge that it's hard to go research if you don't have it. That's one reason that the books, for me, are not difficult to write, because it's just something I know.
Well, you know, I've looked through some of the information on you, and you say, well, the book wasn't hard to write, but I can't believe that you don't look at a sentence and think, is that exactly where I wanted to go with that thought? So when you
Every
say it's
sentence.
Not hard to write.
When I say they're not difficult to write, sure, it's a lot of hard work. But I never, once I got into the appeal and I really got into the rhythm of the story and the pacing of the plot, there's never a down day. There's never a day when I sit down and look at the blank screen and say, what am I going to write today? Because by the time I wake up that morning and, you know, have the first cup of coffee, I know what it's going to be and I can't wait to go do it.
I can imagine that writers listening to this all over America are smacking their foreheads and wishing for a little of that. Well, it's been a real pleasure talking with you.
My pleasure, too.
John Grisham's latest novel is called The Appeal. Thanks ever so much.
Thank you, Jackie.
The Appeal will be released on Tuesday. You can read an excerpt about the verdict that set the whole story in motion at npr.org/books. Our parting words tonight are fittingly about the act of writing. There is a wealth of great writing about writing. Pulitzer Prize-winning African-American writer Alice Walker said, "Writing saved me from the sin and inconvenience of violence." American aphorist Mason Cooley said, "Writing is a refuge from unhappiness, but has its own sorrows." And British novelist Iris Murdoch wrote, "Writing is like getting married. One should never commit oneself until one is amazed at one's luck." And that's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Andrea Seabrook. Have a great week.
While that puzzle challenge is certainly food for thought, you probably need some food to think. How about some Iraqi pastries stuffed with cheese? NPR's Daniel Zwerdling is here for our occasional segment on food and cooking, and he's going to teach us how to make them. First of all, hi, Danny.
Hey, Leanne.
What are these things called?
Cheese sambusaks. And these are savory pastries, by the way. They're not sweet. They make really great party appetizers for the next time you're going to have a party for 200. And actually, I'm not going to make them. We are going to bake them with a wonderful cookbook writer named Greg Patent. Now, Greg has just put out a book called Baker's Odyssey. And the reason I like this book is because it's filled with the recipes of immigrants and immigrants' children and immigrants' grandchildren whom he tracked down all across the country. It's sort of like a global tour through food, Mexico, Norway, South Africa.
Neat. But I have to ask you, you're an investigative reporter. Why do you want to investigate the mysteries of these cheese pastries?
Food was one of my first passions when I came to NPR many, 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 many years ago. I wrote a lot about farmers and agriculture and the food industry and cooking and chefs. So when I heard that you were having an occasional food segment here on Weekend Edition Sunday, I thought this would be the place where I could say in baritone tones, "The sauce was silken." Just kidding, of course. Although we did this cooking segment a little differently.
Yeah.
Greg Patent, the cookbook author, went to his kitchen, which is in Montana. Unfortunately, I stayed here in the studio, and so through the miracle of modern technology, he cooked and gave us a blow-by-blow description of what he was doing while we chatted.
I'm going to have to move a little bit because you're going to have to indulge me, Danny.
And Leanne, before we dive in, talk about the cooking of immigrants. Listen to this. Greg Patent learned this recipe for cheese sambusaks from his mother, who learned it from her mother, who was an Iraqi Jew living in Iraq in the early 1900s. But Greg Patton's grandmother moved with her family to India and then to China, and Greg grew up in Shanghai, and his granny, as he calls her, did most of the cooking.
The apartment where we grew up was, it was one room. I mean one room. It was like about 12 by 15 feet. It had to be bedroom. It had to be dining room. It was kitchen. Granny slept on a cot. My parents slept on a couch that had a hide-a-bed in it, so that every morning everything was kind of folded up and put away. We had a small bathroom, which did not have hot water. So anytime we needed to take a bath, we actually had to order it. So it was a Chinese servant who would carry these big wooden buckets of hot water, and he would carry them up three flights of stairs to where our one-room apartment was located, and then empty them into the tub.
And before we keep talking, I guess we shouldn't forget the recipe. And while you're flinging flour, you can, I want to hear how you put this book together and all the research.
The recipe is cheese sambusaks, which are pastries filled with cheese. And it comes from my grandmother, Granny. And this was a particular pastry she would make very frequently, and I would eat when I came home from school.
Okay, take it away.
Okay. We start off by putting flour and salt and baking powder. And then you'll need to add some cold butter. And then I'm going to pulse until the butter is cut into very, very small pieces. And I'm going to pour in the water until the dough gathers into a ball.
I've always felt suspicious of food processors. Do you really find that the processor can make a flaky, tender dough?
Yes, Danny, I make practically all my pastries and doughs in the food processor.
Sacre bleu!
There. And then I'm going to divide the dough into 24 pieces and then let the dough rest for about 20 minutes.
Can you remember the time, the moment, when you were puttering in your kitchen or whatever, when you thought, aha, I have got to put together a cookbook with recipes from immigrants and their families, like my own?
Well, my last book was Baking in America, where I told the story of America through about 200 years of baking. And that story really had to do with the way Americans adapt and change recipes, and because we always love new things. The flip side of baking in America is learning recipes from immigrants who want to hold on to their homelands in a way that they can only really do by cooking and the food that they left behind.
And before we go on, I should be the evil taskmaster. What do we do next?
The dough is all rested, and what I'm going to do now is I'm going to shred the cheese for the filling. And while we're talking, Danny, I'm just going to pat the circles of dough out into 4-inch rounds. I'll put a piece of cheese on the lower half of each circle, fold the circles in half, pinch firmly to seal, make a little pleat, and brush them with my egg wash, and then get them into the oven.
But, Greg, could I interject for a moment? There are millions and millions of people in the United States who could give you recipes like this from immigrant parents or grandparents. I mean, how do you start tracking down the 100-some recipes in the book?
Well, any gathering that I would go to, I would ask, do you know somebody who does great Polish cooking? Do you know somebody who can teach me some Lebanese cooking? I met Maria Elena Flores, who was the actual first person that contributed to my book. I met her through her daughter in Berkeley, California, when my son was getting his PhD in linguistics. And at his graduation ceremony, he introduced me to Belen Flores, who was kind of the administrator of the graduate program in linguistics. And I said, I see that you're Mexican. Do you do any baking? And she said, the person you really need to get in touch with is my mother. And so she basically offered me up her mother to teach me pumpkin empanadas and buñuelos and flour tortillas, which were all things that her mother made in Mexico. And she continues to make 40 years later in the town that she lives in near Sacramento. And then I needed a Polish baker, and my daughter-in-law and my son were living in Chicago. She told me she would do some checking, and it turned out that next door, her neighbor Liz McDonald had a housekeeper who was Polish. And so when Liz McDonald asked her Polish housekeeper if the housekeeper knew of anyone who could help me out with some Polish recipes, the housekeeper said, he has to meet my mom, Christina. And Christina and I got together. I made a special trip up to Chicago, and we had 2 days of just solid, total baking. Oh, by the way, before we put them in the oven, there's one last step, and that is just brush each pastry lightly with the egg wash. Another thing, Danny, is that a lot of the recipes in the book were traditionally made by many women working together.
Ah.
This was a way of socializing. It was a way of catching up on gossip. When I was up in Albany, New York, I worked with a group of Sicilian American women, and I worked in the kitchen with them for an entire weekend. And it was just fabulous, just being involved in their conversation and trying to remember what they did last year. These are all recipes that these women had learned from their mothers, who were the first generation immigrants. And they didn't necessarily write everything down. They had a recipe template. And they would say, now, did I put in the sweet vermouth or the marsala into the cannoli dough last year? So what these women told me was, they said, we're so glad you're writing this down, because now we will know what to do next year when we make the recipes.
I love it.
Okay. Well, now that the pastries, all the sambusaks, have been brushed with the egg wash, it's time to put them in the oven.
And Leanne, that is where Greg Patton and I very sadly said goodbye.
You didn't even get to taste them. You were 2,000 miles apart. No fair.
I know, but through the miracle of overnight shipping, Greg has delivered the sambusaks to our door. Rebecca, could you come in, please? Our producer, Rebecca Martinez, is a multi-talented young woman, and she...
Hey, Rebecca.
...heated these up in the oven. They've literally just come from Bozeman, Montana.
Oh, look at those. They look like little empanadas.
Every culture has stuffed savory pastries like this. Here, you take the first bite.
Really?
Oh, maybe you'd like to describe the, you know, the texture.
Well, it's very flaky. The pastry is very, very flaky and buttery. So when you put it in your fingers, you know, it leaves this lovely grease on it. And, of course, all the flakiness goes down into the to the plate. So you take a bite.
Shaped like a moon.
It is shaped half moon. Mmm. Mmm.
Stuffed with cheddar.
Is that it?
And I think a mixture of cheese. These really are lovely.
I've been told by my mother not to talk with my mouth full, but, of course, I
won't tattle.
I have to avoid this, so... So what's your next assignment?
Off to Antarctica.
Really?
I'm going to see if the continent is really melting.
Oh, all right. Another investigative report. NPR's Daniel Zwerdling. Hey, Danny, thanks a lot for being a part of our food segment today. Have a great trip. And boy, I really look forward to cooking with you in future segments.
Yeah, me too. Thanks.
You can find recipes for Iraqi sambusaks and Australian lamingtons at npr.org/books. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. Now straight from the co-creator of TV's Cold Case Files, a crime novel called The Chicago Way. It's Michael Harvey's first novel, a modern, high-tech story about a private eye who investigates an 8-year-old case. The plot, written in classic noir prose style, leads to murder and the mob. Rick Kleffel from member station KUSP spoke with the author, who, as a young man at a Chicago law firm, decided to change the direction of his career.
Michael Harvey had enjoyed studying law, but after a couple of years at a law firm in Chicago, he found he didn't have a passion for it. He wanted to write fiction, but decided to hedge his bets.
I didn't feel at that point that 26 years old, that I was just ready to write the great American novel. And I'm probably still not ready to write the great American novel. But I felt like I wanted to write, but I wanted to see more of the world as well. And the thought of being a journalist seemed like a really great combination.
Harvey went back to school for a master's degree in journalism and landed a job working for CBS in Chicago. He went on to co-create Cold Case Files, a crime documentary show for the Arts and Entertainment Network. But his success in the world of nonfiction television didn't stop him from writing fiction.
I had about 50 pages of this. Like a lot of people, I had about 50 pages of this sitting in a drawer for about 2 years, the first 50 pages of Chicago Way, or roughly. And it was just sitting there. And I'd written it. I don't know why I wrote it. I just kind of wrote it on a whim. It was in my head, and I just started writing it. I thought it would be kind of fun with this. I love this style, and I was just kind of messing around, really.
His novel might have remained unfinished if he hadn't asked others to read those pages.
My mom was actually giving me a hard time. You know, moms can be. She's like, you know, what are you going to do with that thing? You know, you got 50 pages. Because she'd read it. She's like, oh, it's good. She's like, why don't you just go ahead and do it?
Harvey had a similar response from Chicago-based writer and professor Garnet Kilberg Cohen.
I sat down with her, and she read the 50 pages, and she's like, this is pretty good. Where's the rest? And I said, well, there is no rest. So she gave me two things. She gave me sort of an editorial focus, and she opened up her calendar book and gave me a deadline.
The deadline proved to be a helpful motivator.
And she said, okay, by the end of the summer, your book is going to be done. And that was a big moment because I was like, well, really, all I have to do is stay alive between now and the end of the summer, and my book's going to be done. And as bizarre as that sounded, that was like really great to me. So I was like, okay, cool. And what it did was, I guess it just quieted all the other voices in my head. And I just said, okay, you know, this is it. For 3 months or 4 months, I'm just going to do this.
Once the decision was made, Michael Harvey plowed ahead.
I was just writing, and the pages began to add up. The story kind of took hold in my mind. I didn't know where I was going. I didn't have an outline. I had some vague ideas of where I wanted to go, but really, the story just started to take hold in my mind as I wrote it.
Harvey's years as a journalist covering crime proved to be a valuable tool when crafting his novel, The Chicago Way.
There's an old saying, you write what you know. And certainly, my experiences in Cold Case Files and in all the documentary work that I've done, all of that stuff influenced this book, you know, dramatically. It's certainly in the atmospherics of the book. You know, I understand the rhythm of the language between cops and prosecutors. I've sat down with killers and talked to them. I know how they work. I know how they think. I know how they talk.
Harvey found that the process of writing fiction changed the way he looked at the world around him. Everything became fodder for the novel.
A lot of this book I wrote in a coffee shop called Intelligentsia, which is in the book. And, you know, I would look out the window and see people walking, oh, you're in the book, you know, and then boom, then they go. I mean, you know, it's really as simple as that sometimes.
Once he'd finished the book, Harvey still had to find a publisher.
I didn't know anybody in the business, really. I didn't know anyone in the book business. So I started Googling agents and looking, doing some research. And I came across this guy named David Gurnett, who has the Gurnett Company in New York. And he happens to represent, among other people, John Grisham. Not that I ever thought he would be my agent, but for a first person to send it out to, I figured, why not start at the top? And this seemed like a really good fit. Plus, he represented the kind of thing that I was writing.
Gurnett emailed Michael Harvey the same day he received the novel, accepted him as a client, and was able to sell The Chicago Way quickly. Harvey has already completed a sequel. This time he set and met his own deadline. For NPR News, I'm Rick Kleffel.
When the dark clouds of World War I began to gather over Europe, in America, the golden age of children's literature was coming to an end. Between 1865 and 1914, some of the best-known juvenile characters had been introduced: Tom Sawyer, Huckleberry Finn, Meg, Joe, Beth, and Amy March. Their stories became classics and sold very well at the time. Perhaps because of the turmoil over there, people needed optimism. Perhaps because of the new industrial age, people wanted stories set in utopian small towns where horses and carriages outnumbered cars. Perhaps because of the sales potential, Eleanor H. Porter's publisher asked her to write a cheerful book. When Pollyanna was published in 1913, it was on the adult bestseller list. Today, the name of the novel's cheerful heroine still echoes in press conferences from Washington to Baghdad.
No one is as much of a Pollyanna as some who say everything is going well in Baghdad. No one actually believes
that. And so I think he can speak the language in a way that says, without sounding like a Pollyanna, we can see this thing through if we make these kind of reforms.
It is not something that happens simply because I send out a memo. I'm not a Pollyanna on that point at all.
Today, as part of NPR's In Character series, we are going to study Pollyanna and try to figure out how a beacon of optimism turned into an empty bubblehead. In Eleanor Porter's novel, Pollyanna is a poor minister's daughter, now orphaned, who goes to live with her wealthy, uptight aunt who dominates a small town. Whenever Pollyanna encounters an obstacle, she plays what she calls the glad game. This is from the 2003 Masterpiece Theater production.
Father taught me it.
What is it?
It started when I wanted a doll, and Father had written asking for one for the charity people. But when it came, there were just some crutches.
Crutches?
If you know. And the game is to find something to be glad about and everything.
How can you be glad about getting crutches if you wanted a doll?
Aha, you're glad because you don't need them. I couldn't see it first. Father had to tell me. I've played it ever since.
Jerry Griswold is a professor of children's literature at San Diego State University. He wrote a history called Audacious Kids. He says Pollyanna came from the same mold as other novels of the Golden Age.
In many respects, it fits perfectly with, for example, Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm and Little Women in the girls' tradition. It has a reputation, like Pollyanna, being a sentimental novel, but you really see a young child who's cunning and optimistic. But I think the other thing you see is that this repeating story of the time period, that they're orphans, that they're being taken in by a sclerotic and unhappy people, and by having that child in their midst, that hard-hearted person's heart is melted by this evangelical child.
By 1946, millions of copies of Pollyanna had been sold. Nationwide, glad clubs had formed. The novel was printed in 11 languages, produced as a Broadway play, and made into several movies, including a silent one starring Mary Pickford. Pollyanna also entered the dictionary as a noun. Merriam-Webster's definition of the term is a person of irrepressible optimism and a tendency to find good in everything. However, the American Heritage Dictionary's definition reads a foolishly or blindly optimistic person. Pollyanna had fallen out of favor.
I think there's always been a sort of alternation in American cultural life that we see on an everyday basis. That is, when someone says something sort of upbeat and optimistic, the antidote or the next sort of reply that comes conversationally is, get real. I think what happened was maybe at this time in America, Americans needed that kind of optimism, that kind of positivity. But after a few years, it began to grow wearisome. In fact, there's a famous cartoon in The New Yorker about shows a little girl underneath a car. She's just been struck by a car. And making fun of Pollyanna, the caption is, "Oh, I'm so glad it was a limousine."
Although the book's reputation was that of a saccharine story about an empty-headed optimist, in 1960, Pollyanna was revived in a big-budget Technicolor movie. This is Walt Disney's definition of Pollyanna.
It means somebody who is so everlastingly optimistic and sunny and cheerful that you can hardly stand it.
Pollyanna introduced British actress Hayley Mills to American audiences.
Do you know why I hate Sunday? Because it means the starting of another week.
That's true.
That's when you can play the glad game.
Here it comes. Miss Goody Two-Shoes is going to find something about Sunday to be glad about.
Oh, lay off her, Angie.
Oh, stop it.
Well, there's always something. You can be glad because...
Well, because what?
Because it will be 6 whole days before Sunday comes around again. Huh?
Hayley Mills made Pollyanna when she was 13. She read Eleanor Porter's book when she was 12.
I think Pollyanna is... she's all children, really, before they turn into adults. She's still somehow free of conditioning. She comes into this town that is controlled and run by her aunt, Polly Harrington. You know, she's a bit of a tyrant. She's a bit of a dictator. She even dictates to the church what's going to be said in the sermons. And this child comes in from a completely different world. And it's her originality as a human being that inspires and transforms that community, I think, that's what they've lost. They rediscover their intrinsic joy and love and connectedness with life through her. She just is like a mirror up to them. I don't quite understand, well, I do to a certain extent, the way that Pollyanna has become this kind of little Miss Goody Two-Shoes, awful saccharine image of a person. I think she's a normal child.
Shortly after Pollyanna became a box office hit and Hayley Mills received a miniature Oscar, Eleanor Porter's novel went out of print in the United States. But in 1969, two researchers wrote an article called The Pollyanna Hypothesis. Margaret Matlin, a psychologist at SUNY Geneseo, co-wrote a 1979 book called The Pollyanna Principle, based on the hypothesis.
And this focused specifically on how people use positive words more often than negative words in the language. One of the things that was most relevant to the Pollyanna hypothesis comes from the frequency of positive words in various languages. If you look at some of the specific counts in literature, for instance, the Bible has many more positive words than it has negative words, but that even applies to James Joyce and William Blake. I don't think anyone would have called either of them a Pollyanna.
Why do you think Pollyanna became a negative? To be called a Pollyanna was a pejorative.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I think it's that uncritical optimism. A person who's a Pollyanna, according to our current usage, is always looking on the bright side and thinking that things will look up, things will get better. And in many cases, that's not the case. I imagine, for instance, many people who many of us know are saying, well, I'm sure the war is not very pleasant right now in Iraq, but things are going to get better. That's a problem that I think we need to deal with. And obviously, Pollyanna didn't have any kinds of concerns of that nature. But if you're simply uncritically optimistic, it is not useful.
It is useful to remember that Pollyanna was different from some of the other juvenile characters created at the time. Her friends were grown-ups. There is only one other character in the book her same age. The themes of unrequited love, despair, and poverty were adult ones. Pollyanna also had a universal appeal. Although her father was a minister and her message to rejoice comes from the Bible, gladness itself did not require faith nor analysis. Happiness simply was not dead. If a new film version of Pollyanna were to be released today, how do you think it would fare?
I think it would fare wonderfully well, because the things that we've just been talking about are perennial. Look at Forrest Gump. You know, he expected the best and got it.
Oh, that's terribly clever. Because really what Pollyanna is and what Forrest Gump are fool figures.
Children's literature professor Jerry Griswold.
If you just look back at your own childhood, do you remember those moments when you were able to, like, manipulate these huge people called adults in one case, and maybe your parents? So this whole sort of notion that you can, you know, act like Lucille Ball with these big people, these grown-ups, and finally get your way shows you that there's this great connection, I think, between the fool figure and the child.
Do you think Eleanor Porter became aware of the criticism of her character, that kind of bubble-headed optimism?
Her position was, she said, I've been made to suffer because of Pollyanna. She says, if I was denying that there was any pain or wrongness in the world, she said that really wasn't what she was doing in Pollyanna. She was just saying that given a choice, she would rather meet the world in a sort of upbeat and cheerful way rather than in some other way.
The novel Pollyanna is back in print in the United States and still sells modestly. Eleanor Porter's archives are kept at Dartmouth University. Hayley Mills is living and working in New York City. And to see the utopian main street of a small American town where Pollyanna and other golden children still spread sunshine, you have to go to Disney World. There's more on our character study on our website, npr.org. NPR's In Character series continues tomorrow on All Things Considered with Scarlett O'Hara. What great American character inspired you? Nominate your favorite on our In Character blog. We might put your suggestion on the radio. Go to npr.org/incharacter. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. Still smiling, I'm Leanne Hansen.
The name Lolita is singed into many minds because Vladimir Nabokov chose it for one of his most vivid characters. Could he do the same for the name Laura? We may never know. The Original of Laura is the title of the author's final work. Nabokov had filled 30 to 40 index cards with a handwritten draft of the novel before he died in 1977, and he left instructions for his heirs to destroy them. He didn't want a rough draft to appear as a book. And yet Laura still exists. Nabokov's son, Dmitri, is on the verge of deciding what to do with the manuscript, and Ron Rosenbaum, columnist for Slate, has corresponded with Dmitri Nabokov about the decision and recently wrote the article, Dmitri's Choice. Mr. Rosenbaum joins us from our studios in New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
And why wasn't Laura burned, in fact, as the author wanted?
Well, Dmitri is in a Hamlet-like position. He has the orders of a stern, dead, ghostly patriarch, his father, Vladimir, saying, destroy the manuscript. And when Vladimir died in 77, he asked his wife to burn this final unfinished manuscript. Mm-hmm. By 1991, when she died, she hadn't done it, and one can understand her reluctance, and the task then passed to Dmitri, who is now 73, and sooner or later has to make a decision about whether to obey his father's final wishes or to preserve for posterity, for scholars, for greedy people like myself who have loved Nabokov's work. And so, you know, curiosity certainly drives us to want Dmitri to preserve it. But on the other hand, it raises the question of shouldn't we respect an artist's wishes not to have his unfinished final work published?
You've been on all sides of this question, haven't you?
Yes. When I first learned about the existence of the Original of Laura, which now reposes in a safe deposit vault in Switzerland, I wrote a column for the New York Observer saying, please, Dmitri, don't burn Laura. But then after it came out, I found myself having second thoughts because I thought, well, you know, where is the respect for Nabokov? Does an artist write to a work of art end when he dies and then we can just disrespect it? Or can we disrespect it because he's a great artist? Should we punish him because he's a great artist? And by saying that we're allowed to disrespect his wishes for posterity, it made me sympathetic with Dmitri's dilemma. And I still don't know how it's going to end up. After my Slate column appeared, I got an email from Dmitri, all in capital letters, in which he was somewhat agitated at all the attention it had brought, although part of me thinks that he may enjoy the attention. Nonetheless, he said that when I make the decision, I will do it privately, and I think he said, tell no one. So for all we know, after Dmitri's death, someone may open the safe and find just ashes within it, or we'll find those index cards, and scholars will begin to puzzle out whether it tells us something more about this amazing writer's work.
Do you know anything about the book?
Well, it's interesting. The 1911 New York Times article called The Original of Gretchen was about a controversy over Goethe's Faust and the character Gretchen in it and who was the model for it. So I guess the original of is a kind of literary term. In other words, the original of Laura would indicate that she is a fictional character, mm-hmm. and the original of Laura would be a real person upon whom Laura was based. And there was someone who, through secondhand knowledge, I think, said something about it being about a lost love. Otherwise, we know very little about it, and Dmitri has been very enigmatic about it.
I mean, on the other hand, it could also be a story about a turtle.
You know, odds are it's not about a turtle, but more likely a butterfly. Those were if it's Nabokov, it's an animal, it's likely to be a butterfly, possibly a caterpillar.
The request that Vladimir Nabokov made for the original of Laura to be burned, it's a request made of someone who's not his literary executor per se. It's his son.
Well, You know, he is now his literary executor. He is
but,
his
but,
son.
But a son has different considerations than a literary executor. I'm just talking about...
I know. I think Dmitri is very divided. He's a son. He's a translator and co-translator with Nabokov. And he's a literary executor. So he's divided in three, at least.
Has he ever said anything to you that indicates that he's read the index cards?
Oh, yes. He did say that he had made a copy onto more conventional manuscript pages of the contents of the index cards. So that might be another way of finessing the ultimate decision. He could burn the cards and keep the copy. And he's characterized it a couple of different ways, or perhaps they're not different. He said, final distillation of my father's art, and he said, a radical departure from the past. It's not necessarily in conflict, but he may be the only one who knows.
Ron Rosenbaum and his most recent book, The Shakespeare Wars, is just out in paperback. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Scott.
From one literary giant to another, we're joined now by our friend Will Grozier, cab driver in London by profession, but a great reader by passion. We talk to him from time to time to get his book recommendations. Will, so good to be back with you.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
It's been far too long.
Far too long. And before we get to your books, what do you think of the... what do you think Dmitri Nabokov ought to do, since they're kind of asking for advice?
Keeping a very simple take on this, if Nabokov couldn't do it, then neither should we. The fundamental question is, was Nabokov capable of destroying this manuscript in his lifetime? Was he physically capable of that act? But obviously he was filled with doubt, and so my guess is that if we were to read this in its proper context, he's really saying this is too big a decision, but to me, I leave it to my heir. And obviously Dmitri is now wrestling with the same problem.
Will, what are you reading these days?
Well, what I'm reading right now is it's a book by a young man called Robert McFarlane called The Wild Places, and it's an excursion into what remains of wilderness in the United Kingdom, which isn't very much, as you can probably imagine. And he has a wonderful prose style. He has a wonderful turn of description. And it's really about a journey that he makes across the western and northern parts of the UK to discover what's left of this sceptred isle. And he talks about writers such as John Fowles and a guy who rejoices in the name of William Least Heat Moon, deriding the UK as being paved over metropolis. And and he sets out really in a journey to discover if there's any truth in this negativity or whether, in fact, you know, the wonderful wilderness that used to exist across the whole of this British Isles still exists. And he does. He finds finds pockets, and he organises the book into a series of paragraphs that run something like island, valley, moor, forest, cape, summit. And so each piece of wilderness is given its own its own chapter. And for anyone that's seeking an escape from the winter urban blues, it's a wonderful book to take you on a journey into the countryside.
Now, you never read more than just one book at a time.
No, that's true. I was bogged down in a parallel race between T.C. Boyle's Drop City and an English author called Kate Moss, spelt with an E. What she does in this book, Sepulchre, it's essentially informed by the power of the tarot, and it's following two parallel stories, one in the late 1800s and a modern-day heroine who happens to be American, so I think that'll be very reader-friendly for your folks over there. It's not profound literature, but it's very well-told story, and it's a great page-turner.
We got out some of the reviews. News of the World calls it essentially a meaty Da Vinci Code.
Yeah, it was a little bit more to it than that, because I know you have reservations about that particular oeuvre, but...
oeuvre?
Well,
oeuvre, yeah.
Oeuvre.
Oeuvre, thank you, yes.
Well, oeuvre, I think, is something that I picked up from Ron Rosenbaum's rant. I just want to pick up on some of the back jacket notes.
Yeah.
Sorry, I have to just go back to Robert McFarlane.
Oh, yes, The Wild Places.
Our old friend Will Self...
whose novel, great novel about the London taxi cab driver,
exactly.
who inherits the world. Yes,
exactly. It was invited to pronounce. And he says a beautifully modulated call from the wild that will ensorcel cell any urban prisoner wishing to break free. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I know this man is a wordsmith par excellence, but ensorcel cell. I had to go to an online dictionary, and it's a derivative of Old French to bewitch.
Oh, ensorcel. Okay.
ensorcel.
All right. Thank you. Ensorcel, because I'm going to start using it a lot. you're also reading a T.C. Boyle book, right?
I have just completed T.C. Boyle's Drop City. This was a publication in 2003, so it's not that old, but it was set back in the 70s in the heydays of the hippie communes in California. Mm-hmm. And it's fundamentally the story of a hippie commune that implodes on itself, as these things did. They then make the long trek to Alaska to escape persecution by the Californian authorities. And it's the story of a fur trapper who is living in Alaska. The sparks that fly when these two diametrically opposed elements of society come into close contact.
What did you find, as the French say, ensorceling about this book?
Its construction of plot, his attention to detail, his observation of character. I've read one book by him before, just Talk.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is a writer worth reading again. Mm-hmm. And I was not disappointed.
Well, Will, you are always a source of ensorcelment.
Ensorcelment.
Yeah. Nice talking to you again, Will.
And you, Scott. I hope to see you soon.
I hope so. Will Grozier from London.
Thank you, sir.
Always a pleasure. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. Have a good weekend. Ensorcel yourselves. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the 286-horsepower TL Type S with a solar sensing climate control system. Learn more at Acura.com.